This is the Rebel Without Applause podcast with Khalid Salam.
Welcome to Rebel Without Applause. This is your host, Khalid Salam. Also here is my producer, Nakia. This episode, we're gonna talk a little bit about poverty and just the issues surrounding that with author Linda Tirado, who is somebody that I think is one of the leading voices, one of the most interesting people regarding that topic. She has a hell of a story herself. And later on the show, you'll get to hear her talk about her story and what she does now to fight against poverty and the perceptions of poor people and all those things that divide us based upon how much money we are worth. Starting off the show, though, I'm going to address the situation that happened in Paris on Friday. It's kind of hard to have any other topic, at least to me. I love Paris. Paris is a great city from so many reasons. And to watch the carnage. Look, it doesn't matter where it is when you see that kind of carnage. It's always bad. But I am especially sensitive to places like Paris, which is a place that I hold dear to my heart. I mean, I love Paris so much. All my social media accounts have photos of the Musée d'Orsay. There's a clock in the main lobby of that museum, and I just think it's a great shot, and I use that as the cover for my social media accounts. So I see Paris every day. So to see what was going on, obviously it's very easy to empathize with people who are eating, at a cafe, walking the street, at a sporting event, living their life, essentially, minding their business, and then boom, your life is totally altered, and for some, your life is taken away. And I think that, this is obviously going to be a major story for the rest of this year and going into next year, and probably for the next 6 months, probably. Now, we'll hear about this every other day, if not every other hour. It'll be a major storyline, for the rest of this year and start of next year, for the next 6 months. We will discuss it and break it down and try to understand what happened and why it happened and prevent things like that from happening again, just like we do after every incident. But I think the fact that it's in Paris makes it a little more intimate for people.
I mean, I guess it'll be discussed until something else happens, because that's how the news is. That's how media is. They pay attention to it. But if it's a big, big story and then something else will happen and then they'll divert their attention to that and then something else will happen.
This won't get bumped, though.
It won't get bumped, but it won't be,
It won't be the lead. It won't be the lead story. It won't be on the top of the fold, as the old journalism term. It won't be on the top of the fold for every day, obviously. But it'll be absolutely discussed. Like every day for the rest of like 2015, certainly. Like, there's no way it's going to come off of being a major story. It's just not possible. There could be other attacks in other places even, and this will still resonate.
Some people are talking about, the thing about social media is that everybody chimes in with their opinions, and that's something I love. But a lot of the sentiment I was reading this morning, people were wondering how come the attacks in Beirut didn't resonate with people the same way. Like, it happened on Thursday. Man, people didn't even know what happened, frankly.
Right.
To me, frankly, it's kind of a false equivalent. Like, it's not, I don't know if you can expect people, certainly here in America, to feel any kind of way towards Beirut versus how they would feel about Paris. Number one, how many people even know where Beirut is? Like, what country it's in? Like, you can ask 10 people, where's Beirut? And I'm telling you, like, two of them know, and then the other eight are like, And you could say, well, name five things about Beirut or the country of Lebanon. And they might not be able to name five things about it. They might name two things. They might name zero things. If you ask somebody to name five things about Paris, they'll do that in a minute flat. Not even a minute. 20 seconds flat. Paris is arguably the most famous city in the world. Everybody knows about Paris. So I don't think it's necessarily fair to compare those two things. I mean, every time there's an attack, there's so many things that happen. People always respond. Basically, you get a lot of the same responses in any of these recent terrorism situations, right? Any of these things involving ISIS, Al-Qaeda, et cetera, et cetera. And it's always there's always a thing of people always say, how can there be so much evil in the world? That is always the thing. And I'm like,
evil has been around since the beginning of civilization.
I was like, there's not any more evil in the world now. The evil was here first. You were just born into it. The evil was already here. And I'm saying the world is probably less evil now than it was 100 years ago. Certainly than it was 500 years ago. Like the evil in the world that we have in 2015 is a less evil than what we had in generations past. Like people are less crazy now. The issue is people have better weapons. That's all. You know, so either the evil is the same or it's worse. But the evil isn't new. It isn't like, oh, things got, you know, worse in modern times. People always say, where is this evil coming from? Why is there so much evil in the world? I was like, this is what the world is. The world is evil. People are most, like, there is definitely an inherent trait amongst humans that are filled with anger, negativity, jealousy, selfishness, greed, neglect, all the things that we categorize as evil, right? People are power hungry. People are villainous. They are filled with revenge, et cetera, et cetera. Like evil, we say evil like it's like, oh, evil, like it's like a catch-all phrase. Evil is just whoever you aren't in a lot of ways. You know, like, okay, I'm not evil, fine. Is someone else evil? Depending what they do to you or to something that you value. You know, those phrases are to me very fluid. And in these moments, they often come across on, I mean, this is where religion plays its biggest part. And this is where I always tell people always ask me, why is it that I'm not that religious? Why is it that I don't super subscribe to a particular ideology? And to me, it's very easy. It's times like this that make it easy for me personally to not really be that religious. It's times like this in which I say to people, I believe in God, and I believe in humanity and love and sacrifice and honor and loyalty. I believe in God. Organized religion, that's another thing entirely. Entirely. There's no religion in which I take any literal sense. And the thing about the you know, these terrorists, or whatever how you want to frame them or call them, whatever term you feel fine. I'm fine using the word terrorist in this incident. I don't care. Is that anybody who is a fanatic about their religion, that's somebody that I don't really want to be around. I don't care what religion it is. I don't trust anybody who loves their religion more than they love anything else. I might tolerate some people, but I don't really rock with you if you're really religious. I'm like,
Because if you care more about the religion than humans, then you don't really have much to discuss.
It's just not trustworthy because I don't know what you're willing to do. Because the thing about religion that compels people is that nobody's wrong. Because we don't know if anybody's right. And so if your religion says XYZ is the way to get your blessings, it's the way to get to heaven, it's the way to be a proper person in your religion. If you believe in that stuff literally, like all the way to the letter, it makes total sense to you. Even though to me it makes no sense, or to someone else it makes no sense. What are the things that compel people to do things? Religion, fear, anger, hopelessness. Right? Religion wraps all those things together, and can use it in any way they want to. And I always say the reason why religion works because it doesn't have to be proven. Other things you have to prove it. If someone says this is true, I'm like, show me how it's true. Prove that it's true to me. And someone either does or doesn't, and then you either believe them or often you do not believe them. With religion, you don't have to prove anything. Someone says, this is true. And then you say, prove it. And then they say, well, I cannot, but I know it's true. But it's like, based on what? And it's based on nothing. Every religion, every single one, has in its text information that actually is illogical and isn't based on science. But nobody cares if you're in a religion. It doesn't matter.
And then they pick and choose what they will hold to be true.
Yeah.
You know, they'll go in the Bible and say, well, this is wrong. And then in the sentence right after what's wrong, it could be something that's equally wrong, but to them, it's right. And to them, they live their life by that, by being all self-righteous when all of it is wrong. Because nobody actually came down from the heavens and said, hey, this is what it is.
But the amount of blood.
You're going by a book made by a man or a couple of men.
The amount of blood shed over religion, incalculable. Nobody knows. Nobody has any idea. And for me, I always try to get to an understanding of, okay, certainly if you have a name like me, anytime these incidents happen, you're always like, oh, there we go. Now, some people take it super sensitive. I don't. But I know a lot of people do who have Islamic names are like, oh, well, Islam is not a religion of violence. These are extremists. We're not all da-da-da. We're not all terrorists. I'm like, I don't really try to do that. I don't really try to, you know, like, if somebody asks me directly, sure, I guess I'll respond. But I don't get on social media and I don't, like, try to start that debate because, to me, I don't have anything to apologize for. I'm like, whatever's going on in the mind of a dude who's in ISIS, I A, do not know, B, do not care, C, do not take any responsibility for that in any way at all, whatsoever. People might assume, and again, I'm not that religious, but people just make assumptions based on, well, his name is, last name is Salam.
He's obviously.
He asked to be. I'm like, I don't really care.
Right.
I don't give a shit about whatever's going on. I care about people being safe. So like, if people talk bad about the people in those groups, I'm like, talk bad about them. I don't give a crap about those people. Fuck them. I don't give a shit about any of them. Because I guarantee you, had I been in Paris and one of them cafes and that shit was going down, I would have been dead too. I'd have been shot too. I'm like, hey man, my last name is Salam, so you're not gonna shoot me, right? They would have blasted me like anybody else. It would not have mattered,
right?
Because they have an agenda that is different from anything else. Their agenda is like, we're gonna do what we're gonna do, and we don't care. And the mentality, and if you're compelled, if you're a suicide bomber, you're being compelled by something that I can't relate to. I don't know what it takes to be a suicide bomber, and I don't want to know. But that's not in Islam. I mean, you can't even commit suicide in Islam. It's like actually a sin. It's like eating pork or something. Like people, it's like you can't do that. Actually, it's actually in the text, but they, obviously they don't care.
They interpret it how they
want to
see
right.
fit. And so, I mean, but this is also like in slavery, they would pray to Christ, Jesus, a white Jesus. And think it's okay to keep the slaves.
I mean, you can do.
I mean,
way more current. And I always tell people my example in these kind of moments.
You're burning a cross, but you're Christian.
My example in these moments is oftentimes like westward expansion, just as a country. Like every person, all those plain states we settled, all those western territories we settled, those people were super religious, super. They were super, and they believe in their God and their text, and that just happened to be the Bible, right? And this wasn't centuries ago. This is within recorded modern history. And then when we got to the coast and got to the Pacific Ocean, people said, guess what? We're taking our religion, and we're going to keep going. So they went to Hawaii. And I always tell people, how do you think Hawaii became part of the United States? Hawaii is really, really far from the mainland. It ain't like relatively close. And the story, this is how the story is. People went there and they send the missionaries first and they say, here's our book. Here's our God. Take it. And then, you know, people say, well, I don't really want that. And the missionaries are like, are you sure? Because I'm not going to ask you a third time. I don't really want that. Fine. Missionaries go back. And then people come back with guns and say, this is your religion now. You don't like it? Pow. That's a bullet for you. That's just how it goes. That's just how it went. That's the story of Hawaii. We don't really talk about that in our history books, but it's there. You can easily find it. But we don't really discuss it in social studies class. And that's religion. Religion can compel people to do things that don't really make sense in a logical argument. And the stuff that happened in Paris, that hurts my heart. And I absolutely, absolutely hope that they're able to find whatever people who are still connected. I know like the initial bombers and initial people have been killed. But there's people are connected to that, that are still alive, obviously. I want all of those people tied up and blasted. I don't care at all. I don't care at all. Doesn't mean anything to me whatsoever. So I don't care what happens to any of those people. And I don't feel like I have to feel the brunt of the I mean, there's going to be negativity, of course. And people are going to, you know, point to people with names like mine. And that's fine. Like, I don't really worry about, you know, there'll be a lot of right wingers making connections and blah, blah, blah. I don't really care about those people anyway. You know, like, they were never going to be in my side regardless of anything. So for them to go on social media or go on any news programs and talk shit about people with my name, talk your shit, man. I don't care. I have zero fear. Because the truth of the matter is, if you don't understand the nuance and the differences, like, people are like, well, you know, we gotta watch out for all the refugees. Maybe we shouldn't let the refugees into this country, into that country. I'm like, what do you think the refugees are actually running from? It isn't just like they're,
why do you think they're refugees in the first place? Hello?
Because they're like these, I don't even know what it's, you can't even say that they're just like fanatics or extremists. We need like another word above that. I don't even know. Like, is there another word beyond extremist? I don't really know. Are they just like shit crazy? I don't know. But whatever. There are people leaving these countries who are like, I don't want to be around these crazy ass ISIS people. And they are running rampant in this city, in this neighborhood, whatever, whatever. I don't really rock with them. Now, yeah, some people are leaving for financial issues and to have a better life, but a lot of it's just like these parts of the world are being overrun by these religious, like, I don't even know, extremists, psychos, whatever word, whatever negative term you could think of. And for us in the States and just the West in general, it's like we are engaged in this battle. And so the questions, you know, you see a lot today are, you know, what's next? What do we do? I was like, what do you mean, what do we do? We can't get out of that part of the world. It's too important strategically. We can't get out. It's too important strategically. And we all know that. And dealing with these potential situations, these incidents, these moments of terror and horror, this shit's the new normal. Unfortunately, I think it's something that we all sort of know, but it's like, damn it, another reminder. It's awful. I'm going to end right there. Coming up after the break, I'm going to speak with Linda Tirado, author of the book Hand to Mouth, Living in Bootstrap America, which is an interesting book. I think it's a book that everybody should certainly read and certainly be aware of at minimum, because I think there's a lot to be said in the wage issues that she deals with and just how we view the poor in this country. And the holiday season is coming up, right? It's about to be Thanksgiving, Christmas, et cetera, et cetera. This is the time of year where everybody sort of is okay with people being poor. They love the poor for these few weeks. And people are volunteering more, giving away coats, food, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, to me, it's always like, it's a great thing, obviously, but it's, I always feel like, how come we can't sustain that level of love for other people? And, you know, I'll discuss that with her and just, you know, whatever else she's dealing with, and she's working on. After the break, this is Rebel Without Applause. Your host, Khalid Salam.
Mm-hmm. Yes, this is the ghetto.
You're listening to the Rebel Without Applause podcast with Khalid Salam.
Linda, how are you?
I'm good. How are you, baby?
Very good. Very good. Before we get into to your story, which I think is obviously a great, great story for you. I know you're in London right now. You've been in London for the last few weeks or months, right?
Yeah, about a month now, yeah.
Can you just give me a general idea of how people in London are reacting to the attacks in Paris and just European media in general?
You know, I don't know how the media has reacted necessarily, because the only other time I've been in Europe was when I was on my book tour, so I don't really have a flat gauge for it. But there's a thing here near what is kind of the equivalent to Veterans Day. It's called Remembrance Day. And people wear poppies on their lapels. And it's generally, it's a lot like wearing a flag pin or displaying a flag on Veterans Day or Memorial Day. And there's a certain kind of person that you expect to see wearing a poppy. And you don't expect to see a tall man in a very nice suit on High Street wearing a poppy and just saying the word égalité over and over and over, just equality in French, because it's, liberté, fraternité, égalité is the French revolutionary call, obviously. And you don't expect to see a man in a poppy in tears on a High Street just repeating French revolutionary words to himself over and over. It's hit people here in an incredibly interesting way, because England and France have such a close and weirdly complex relationship. They're like people who have married each other 5 times,
right,
and like divorced every time. So it's been really interesting the next day after. Most of last night, because obviously it was in the evening here, so most of last night was everybody I know making sure that all of their friends were okay and all of their families okay. Today we've largely spent doing relief work, actually, and trying to make sure that everybody's got what they need and that there aren't any French citizens who are stranded in England that anybody knows that need housing. But what's also happening in England is that people are paying a lot of attention to Calais, which is a city obviously on the north side of France, but it's where a lot of Syrian refugees and a lot of immigrant refugees have been staying, and they have this kind of shanty town that's sprung up in Calais. And last night, almost simultaneous to the terrorist attacks in Paris, a fire started and wiped out 40 homes in this little, not little, actually, very large encampment that these refugees have set up. So there's an awful lot of relief work here in London, because I think people largely know, it's terrorism, it's this huge thing. The people here trust the government to be doing something about that, but people feel a real attachment to these folks and claim a real responsibility for them, even though they haven't been able to find asylum in the UK yet.
Wow, that's interesting. It really is. I hadn't heard that yet. That news hasn't filtered it over into American media, as far as I know.
Yeah, I wouldn't think. I saw a lot of mention about it on Twitter, but that might just be because I'm geocoded to see UK Twitter at this point.
Okay. Okay. No, that was good. I just figured you being over there, you definitely had a perspective to share.
I think you guys probably knew more about it than we did, because it was on a Friday night. So I don't think the news actually had really hit and kind of struck, everybody's out with their friends, everybody's out on dates, nobody's actually checking the news at 8, 9 p.m. on a Friday. So I would imagine that if you were watching social media very closely, you probably had a better idea of what was happening than we did, just because it was the middle of the workday there. And so you would have that kind of, you would have heard about it immediately. And so you would have like better information than we did at that point.
Yeah, it happened right in the, towards the latter part of the news day, still afternoon time. And, obviously everybody who's working is still in front of a computer and et cetera, et cetera. So yeah, it was, it blew up obviously very quick over here.
I think that is actually one thing that's probably very different. In discussions about what shall we do tonight, shall we keep our plans, what should we be doing, should we not go out, should we go out, that kind of discussion that was very familiar to me from after 9/11 of like, okay, well, how do we basically tell them they don't get to stop us from having lives? But also, how do you, be respectful of what's happened? And there's a certain amount of fear.
Absolutely.
People are very aware of who's taking credit for these attacks and why. And obviously, you've got Poland already. Their new right-wing government coming in has said they're going to stop allowing Syrian immigrants into the country. And that's starting to happen across the EU. So there's been a lot of discussion today about what's actually going to happen with the refugee crisis, because every government in the EU can set their own policy if they have to. And where you're already talking about a couple of countries having open discussions about whether or not to even stay in the European Union, it's been really, really interesting to watch kind of the geopolitics shift this might actually be a crisis for the European Union, because you're going to have countries coming down on one side of how to handle it and countries coming down on the other, and everybody's going to feel very morally correct in their position. So,
no, it's going to be a very complex situation that all of us here in the States will obviously be watching. But let me get back to you, because that's why, you know, I should be on the show, because I really feel like in the area of poverty, your voice is one of the most dynamic, certainly in the U.S., if not the entire world. For those who are not familiar with your story and how you came basically from a Gawker post into an author, can you just give a quick summary of how you got to where you are?
Yeah, the 30-second version, it sucks to be poor. I complained about it on the internet, and then I got a book deal. but no, honestly, what happened, I was talking with some friends of mine online, just in a discussion board, mm-hmm. and somebody who had, you know, a fair bit of privilege in their life said, hey, remind me why again it is I'm not supposed to, you know, be a little hurt when I see somebody using my tax money in a way that I disagree with. And I basically told her, well, until you're the one making those decisions, you don't get to make that value judgment either. And that kind of piece that I that reply that I wrote went super, super viral. And once you've done super, super viral, the rest of it kind of comes along. And now I'm in London teaching at a university here. So that's been pretty awesome.
How's that going?
It's really interesting, actually. It turns out, outside of America, people don't actually know what America's like. They know what our media shows them. So people's vision of America is very much like guns and the Kardashians and like everything they've seen in Hollywood and The Wire.
The
like, that's it. That's
Wait,
it.
Why,
like, that's all
why,
I know
why
about.
The Wire?
It's hugely popular. It's hugely popular overseas. I swear
even,
to God.
Even though it's
like,
been off,
of the
it's been off
of, the world,
of the air for... Like what, 7 seasons or so?
And yeah. No, they all know The Wire, and they all ask me about it. Like, this is people's picture of America, is basically John Wayne, The Wire, the Kardashians, and movies, and George Bush, and that's America. And so when I go to them and I go, hey, you do realize that privatization has a downside, right? Like, one of the reasons I work in the UK is David Cameron, who's the government leader, the leader of the Conservative Party.
Mm-hmm.
Really wants to cut their National Health Service and privatize a bunch of it. And the thing about England is that, like, you know, they vaguely have different benefits than we do, but you don't know necessarily, as like a working class person in America, these people, if they get a sniffle, they go to the doctor to make sure there's nothing actually wrong with them. Like, just in case something might be coming on, they go just in case.
So they're very proactive. They're proactive.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, the incentive structures here are for health outcomes and not for billing. It's very much, but everybody feels entitled to medical care. That's part of being a British citizen, is that you'll never be sick and not be able to go see a doctor. That's what your taxes pay for. And the NHS has been around for decades and decades and decades now. They put it in, you know, basically because of the war. And so to go to Britain and say, hey, you do realize that I did not see a single doctor in my entire adult life unless I was actually so hurt somebody forced me to go to the hospital or I was having a baby.
Those are the only reasons
I would go to doctors. And they go, what do you mean? What do you mean? Why would you go to a doctor for a sniffle, dude? I can't afford that. And so you have these conversations, and their minds are blown. And so what I've realized, frankly, is that, you know, we use these same words, right? We use things like the welfare state. And when a person in the UK talks about their welfare state, they're talking about benefits that last from when you are 18 years old until you die. They're talking about, you know, unemployment that mostly pays out. They're talking about medical care that is cradle to grave. Anytime you're sick, you go to a doctor. That is a welfare state. And so for our politicians to say, oh, welfare state, that's a great turn of phrase. I think we'll use that. And what they're talking about is food stamps that are $146 a month for a family of six. And they're talking about housing benefits, that if you're lucky enough to get on the list, you've got a 10-and-a-half-year wait before you get to the apartment that you no longer qualify for because you moved out of the county that one time 4 years ago for 3 weeks. That's not a welfare state. America does not have a welfare state. And so when we kind of talk between us in the working classes, we really compare lives, we start to go, oh my God, we're all getting screwed.
What is the general attitude towards the working poor or even the truly poverty stricken versus how it is here in the States? What have you seen?
You know, it's hard to make that distinction. Britain has a much stronger class system than America. We have a very strict class system, but we like to pretend that that's not the case. In Europe, in Britain particularly, what you're wearing, and the second you open your mouth and people hear your accent, they know what class you were raised in, what section of the country, what section of the city, if you're from a city. It's incredible the kind of nuanced class divisions that they have here. So what that does is partially, if you open your mouth and you prove yourself low class, nobody actually judges you for being in the working class, because what else were you supposed to do? That's where you live. That's who you are. And there's nothing actually inherently wrong with that. Now, we're still, you know, nobody's going to invite a poor person to tea.
Well, I was
going to
say, can you,
house, you know,
what's the social mobility like? Can you go from a poverty class to a higher class easily based upon, you know, your career or something?
You can definitely jump classes, yeah, based on your career. And that seems to be a lot like America. Of if you're super hardworking and you're pretty intelligent and you're willing to, like, basically make a bunch of really bad deals on the hope that one of them pays off for you, and then you have a brilliant stroke of luck. Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And it's like that in the States, too, where here the poor are supposed to work. They're supposed to work hard all of their lives, and they'll be rewarded for it. And then every now and again, somebody is, and everybody goes, look, see, the system works.
Right.
And they don't understand that for that one person, for every person like me. I mean, and not even like me. I'm such an anomaly at this point. But for every person that writes something on the internet that's heartfelt about why, at the end of my third shift today, you don't get to complain at me because you think I'm doing life wrong, right? Like, how many people have written that sentence in some form just today in America on the internet? And how many of them are going to be on the front page of Forbes?
Let me ask you this.
Odds against it are astronomical.
Let me ask you this. This is the time of year when being poor is quote okay, you know, like people are much more loving towards the poor. The language changes, you know, from about, you know, mid-November to New Year's Eve, being poor is okay. And for many, you know, for many years, I've often felt sort of torn about that. And in one way, it's like, well, at least there are some recognition of people who are struggling, even if it is for a few weeks. But then I feel like, how come this recognition can't be a regular thing? I'm always torn in that way.
If it wasn't special, then how would they know they felt right?
Right.
If you just felt good towards your fellow human beings and felt like you maybe had an obligation to make sure that things weren't so blatantly unequal, that for you to have your comfortable life, 100 families have to live in gut-wrenching poverty, well, November and December is when we put those feelings aside and we're charitable to our fellow human beings and we make sure that we care about them so that we know we're good people. Because at the end of the year, at the very end of the year, at New Year's, when we're making our resolutions, we're not going to have to resolve to be nice to the poor, are we? We've just done that for 2 months.
Right. And then it's nothing. You know, it's like you're back to being on your own and damn whatever else you're asking for, whatever you need. It's a funny thing that happens every year. People giving away free turkeys. I'm like, people need turkeys in September, too.
You know, and part of that too is because November and December is when we culturally make it the easiest for people to do. The thing is, people need turkeys in April just as well, but there's not a handy bin at the grocery store saying, hey, can you chuck a couple of bucks in here so we can buy a turkey?
Right.
Because there's no holiday. The thing is that
nobody
wants poor people. Nobody thinks poor people shouldn't be allowed to celebrate Christmas. Like, nobody thinks that. Nobody.
What about their birthdays? Is that the limit, just Christmas? What about other holidays?
Well, but that's the thing, though, is we all have birthdays, but all of our birthday celebrations are different, aren't they? You have a quinceañera. You have, you know, whatever cultural things you have. Everybody's birthdays are much more personal. Christmas, Thanksgiving, that's the thing that we do as Americans where we all get together as a family. And there is not one single date in the rest of the calendar, barring maybe the 4th of July, where everybody's meant together and do food, right? it's Thanksgiving and Christmas, basically. So, I mean, part of it's just that it's easy. Part of it is that, you know, suddenly every church in the world is talking about what it would be like to be pregnant, to be 7 months pregnant, and have to find a place to have your baby in, you know? And those messages and those sorts of things pluck heartstrings, and they remind people of what they don't remember every day. And you know, this is not to say that folks with privilege don't care. I think that they do. I think that when you don't have to think about deprivation all of the time, you naturally don't. I think that's more what it is.
You have the option.
When you're, yes, you have the option. It's like being white. Like, dude, I feel awful most of the time. For any time, like, look what's going on in Mizzou. Look at what's going, you know, anywhere in the country, right? Like, it's got to be hell to be black in America. It's got to be absolutely unimaginable hell. And, you know, the beautiful thing about privilege, and it's awful that I'm the only one that gets to do this, but it's the thing I can do, is go for a drink with my friends and never once think, I wonder if I'm going to get, like, torn up by this bartender. Like, I don't ever have to think about that. And so for me, I have to actively keep that mindset open. And I think the more privileges that you pile on top of each other, the harder and harder it gets to do that. And I think that's probably a legitimate thing. Like, if you were trying to live your life and you didn't have it in your face all of the time, your natural human instinctiveness would keep you away from the pain sometimes. And it would tell you it's okay not to feel other pain sometimes. You know, and I think so. It's all on a continuum. But the point here is that when the problem is systemic and we're talking about individual solutions, we're never going to get anywhere. The problem is that we haven't set up these systems. We haven't set up a system that doesn't have white supremacy written into every structure. We don't have a system that's set up that doesn't have, you know, inclusion for the wealthy and exclusion for the poor written into every line. And so the problems that we face are systemic. I don't think that you're going to find many people who are going to look at you and be like, no, I hate poor people. I think they're useless. Mostly you'll hear, oh, I think they must not have taken advantage of their opportunities. And then if you sit them down and you go, okay, well, look, here's my life. Where do you see the opportunity I should have taken? And they go, oh, well, there wasn't really one, was there? Well, no. No, there isn't for me or for anybody else. So what do you think we should do about that? You know, it's two different conversations.
When you're touring around the country, giving speeches and going to all these fancy initiatives regarding poverty and wages and et cetera, what are the kind of questions that people ask you? Because I feel like there's a sense from the outside that people either hate the poor, like actually hate them, or don't understand them in any way outside of a surface level. So what are they asking you about? What are the
questions you're going to have? I'm gonna say for the most part it's that second. If it's hatred, it's what I have found, and look, this is my own observations, this is not a scientific study or anything. Mm-hmm. What I've found is when it's hatred, it's that they cannot figure out how to deal with being a moral human being and also a privileged one. And mm-hmm. So it must be those guys. Those guys are just terrible. They don't deserve it. That's why they don't have it. It's not because I'm lucky. It's because they're bad. And I found that's largely it. But no, they asked me, what can we do? How do we help? Frequently, I get asked about programs that they set up that I have to keep a straight face through, because he knew as soon as they started to say it, I was like, this is the stupidest thing ever. And then they go, and nobody showed up.
Well, give me an example.
And we tried to give them. A think tank brought me this pilot program. It spent $500,000 on it. Mm-hmm. And what they'd done was alternative art therapy for children that was available on Tuesdays and Thursdays from 3:30 to 5 for free to any mom who cared to bring their kids. And that was it. That was the whole program. They spent $500,000 on it. They never asked whether art therapy was a thing that would be useful, particularly in
Chicago.
Where
does the money go to exactly? $500,000 goes into what exactly?
It goes into paying employees, into insurance, into renting spaces, into the 10 months of pilot program development where they're paying two staffers to come up with this idea and call around and find local organizers that think it's fantastic and want to chart it. You know, the infrastructure, the thing, when you see a giant organization come in, it's not that they're not well-meaning, it's that they bring all of this infrastructure, and infrastructure is expensive, but it's also really handy. That's why they use it. One of my favorite examples, I actually applied for a job, a political post, that would have been political organizing in the lower classes, and this was years and years ago. And somebody said, well, imagine you've got two separate community leaders and that you just can't get them to get along, but they're, you know, really becoming a problem. What do you do? And I said, I invite them over for dinner. I have a barbecue. I have a lot of beer and a lot of barbecue, and I have 100 people in my backyard. And then those three of us talk, and then we get it sorted. And she actually started laughing at me in the interview, and obviously I didn't get hired. And I've thought about that for years and years, and now that I do what I do for a living, I actually use it as an example, because I didn't realize why I was so offended when she started laughing. And what I realized is she asked me, how do you solve a problem in your community that you belong to that I'm not a part of? And I said, look, here's how you get it done. And she started laughing. I said, no, I mean, in our way, how would you use our way to get it done? Well, if you want me to use your way, honey, hire somebody like you. You've got me in here interviewing because this is my skill set. These are my people. This is my culture. I know how to work within my own culture. And so these organizations, you know, largely these are folks that know that they don't know, and they're doing the best that they can. But it has not for once, for example, in a program that was meant to help people learn cooking skills, things like what do you do with leftovers? How do you start a cooking course where you're like, right, we have this, here are our ingredients. We're going to make this one thing on Monday, and it's huge. But, you know, we're going to use that, like, three-quarters of the pot that's left over on Tuesday to make this completely different thing, right? It was this really cool program. But they couldn't get anybody in. And I'm like, you are sending white Harvard graduates to Watts. It's not going to happen. And by the way, why are you not hiring the interested residents of Watts to teach this class? If you're concerned with these folks, why are you not showing them a respect of saying, we think you're good enough to teach and you can teach your neighbors? You want respect. You have to show us some first. And when you come in from the top down and impose your structures and programs, sweetheart, we don't do well under your structures and programs. How dumb do you think we are? And so a lot of what I actually do is telling people, like, I understand you're trying to help, but you do see how your help is insulting, right? And maybe where we start is by not insulting the people we're trying to help. And that honestly is most of my work.
In these programs you hear about, how many of them are focused towards rural America, poor white communities, et cetera, et cetera?
No. Very, very few.
Really?
The thing is that you're talking about organizational money, so they're going to have to go back to the people that gave them the money and say, here's what we did. Here's how many people we've affected. Here's how effective your donation was. Please give us another. If you go to where I used to live in West Virginia, where there might be 20, 30 people every couple of square miles, you know, you're talking three or four families, the amount of time and impact that dollar is going to make is a lot less than if you go to, say, Cincinnati, where I live right before West Virginia, where we're all piled on top of each other in the building. You've got, you know, 1,000 people every 500 square feet. So, and also there, and this is a true thing, everybody wants to not be a racist. And so the one way that you prove that you really care about your own privilege and people that aren't white is you make all of your programs specifically for some ethnic minority community. And then when you point out that it's mostly white staff, they go, no, but we're not racist. Look, we help black people and brown people all of the time. That's all of our programs right here. Like, we don't even have a white people program. There's not a single program white people are even allowed to apply for. That's how not racist we are.
It's so, because the thing about these issues is they should not be so racially concentrated. Like, if you're poor and starving, you're poor and starving, period. And I think a lot of that, there are a lot of internal issues with how we frame poverty, who we think is quote unquote poor, and how we treat those people. There's not nearly enough attention, or even sometimes respect, I think, towards those rural areas where people are also struggling.
You know who if we're going to split by race and demographic in those ways, the people who are getting the most screwed are rural, poor Black people. That's the kind of entrenched racism that a lot of these programs are supposed to be set up to fight, but then they're being administered in cities where racism is real, but ain't nobody getting, you know, beat up by Bubba in the back of his truck and nobody heard about it until 3 weeks later, right? Like, it's an entirely different thing. And so you have these programs that are focused on solving this one problem, and they're being applied in the wrong capacity. But more to the point, when we talk about the difference between white poor and Black poor and Hispanic poor and Asian poor, whatever it is we're talking about, those are rich people terms. And when we have our conversations, we're using the academic language that these folks at Harvard dreamt up. And the trouble is that they had a point. It was great at the beginning. You know what we need to do? Pay really close attention to the fact that if you administer a program that's colorblind, you are leaving out half of what that program needs if half of its users are not white. White people, we don't got a bunch of those problems. There needs to be special attention. There needs to be special focus. And it's not because it's extra. It's because we're trying to bring everybody to parity, and some of us are just not as far behind as far as the parity race. And so you give everybody what they need based on their circumstance, and that was supposed to be the point of even discussing race to begin with, was, okay, now we care about the fact that some people are rich and poor. Great. Now let's care about the fact that some people are rich and some people are poor and some people are poor and Black. And that's like a whole other thing, right? And now we've kind of taken it to that nth degree because academia does that to everything eventually. But when we have these conversations amongst ourselves, we're using all of this academic crap terminology because, quite frankly, when I was living in the buildings in Cincinnati, I was the only white person for 4 blocks, and ain't nobody that actually lived near me cared. I was making as much money as them. I was living in exactly the same places, shopping at the same, you know, like, it didn't matter. I was in exactly the same boat. And when I lived out in West Virginia and there's only one Black family for God knows how many miles, nobody treated them any different. Well, at least not the people that weren't actively racist, because West Virginia. But the people right. who would be have been prone to talk about, you know, racial differences in this context, you know, none of us actually cared. It didn't ever occur to us, except for that we thought it sucked when they had to face racism, you know, and we tried to keep it in check as much as we knew how. And that was the best we could do, but nobody was gonna be like, well, those guys aren't gonna benefit from this rural program because they're Black and so they got different problems than we do. Well, shit, no, we all needed food. We all needed food. We all needed transportation. We all needed help getting our roofs replaced. Like, your roof doesn't care what color your skin is.
Not at all.
You know, like, no, it doesn't matter. But so I think a lot of the problem is that we frequently have these conversations and we are so afraid of being written off, and we're so afraid of coming across as uneducated or, you know, whatever it is, that we don't stand up and we go, you guys do know, and I'm assuming we're on pre-record, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Then you know, we don't ever stand up and go, you guys do know you're full of shit at this point, right? Like, you long ago left the conversation where we were relevant, and you weren't just listening to yourself.
Let me get you out here on this last question about minimum wage. Obviously, in some parts of the country, they've raised it $15 an hour. And it's become more of a mainstream issue than I've ever remembered. Are you surprised that it's gone this far? And do you think there's more room for it to continue to grow? Or is this the peak of that issue?
Yes and no, which is the same. I'm surprised it's now, but it was inevitable. There's no way we didn't have this conversation. It was getting too far disparate for too many people and too obviously for us to not have this conversation. I'm a little shocked at how quickly it happened, I think, more than anything, where we were talking about poverty. And quite frankly, you know, the luck of that timing is the only reason I have a career at all. It's the only reason I do any of this, because I wrote my thing about this time last year, 2 years ago, or 2 years ago, I mean. So the discussion has gone much, much quicker than I anticipated or would have thought. I don't, I think it's going to lose steam just because of the way that we've dealt with it. And I don't necessarily know there was any other way to do it, but the problem we're going to run into is that a $15 minimum wage doesn't make sense in the country. It doesn't. You've got, you know, these tiny towns, everybody's getting, you know, $7-$8 an hour. Even the wealthiest people are getting $10 or $12 an hour. It will destroy a lot of small economies. And so if, I think if we'd gone and said, look, the military pays a living stipend to active duty and veterans, depending on the zip code they live in and the cost of living in that zip code. And we're just going to expand that so that the living wage or the minimum wage is whatever's reasonable in that area that you can, you know, keep yourself on. We already have that structure. It's already national. We've already been using it for 50 years with no problem. We've processed millions of people through that system without problem. And I think that we should have said, look, this is a complex issue. You know, on the other hand, can you ever say that ever in America anymore? I don't know. And the trouble with poverty is, as an issue, or the trouble with working class issues generally, is that none of it is simple. None of it is simple. We can't just fix it. It's never going to happen. And so it can't be a quick, simple solution. My biggest fear is that we get to $12 nationally on the minimum wage and everybody goes, right, we've done poverty now. What should we talk about next? And then we're going to be on to something else entirely. And I think it's down to those of us that do this work to be like, right, okay, well, we got your one symbolic point. Now, are you actually going to do this or not? And I think it's going to be up to us to refuse to let the issue drop.
Okay. Linda Tirado, as I expected, you were great. You brought many great perspectives. And just, you know, I mean, like, you're a dope-ass person, just for the record.
And I appreciate it.
And I appreciate your agenda and your fight.
Hey, whatever we can do. You know, honest to God, though, not like the airing short story example, but this guy that was crying with the poppy on, like, he was a wreck. And it was all over. Like, people, like, you couldn't be French in Paris or French in London today because people would ask you, are you okay? Is your family okay? And people would just come up and you know, a quarter of England speaks French anyway. And so, like, I started hearing people speak French where there wasn't French before. And the number of times I've heard the phrase Vive la France in the last 24 hours, which is a French revolutionary slogan. So I've been actually just kind of going like, well, all right, English. French revolutionary as it is. Great.
Right.
So you are fantastic, and I'm happy to have done it, and let me know anytime you've got more space, yeah?
Awesome. Thank you for your time.
Okay. Linda.
Thank you for listening to Rebel Without Applause. You can find me on Twitter at Mr. Khalid S, MrKhalids. Get at me if you want to talk about what we discuss in the show, or you want to discuss anything that I've discussed in the past. I'm always here to dialogue with the like-minded. Thank you for your time. Peace.
Follow Khalid on Twitter at Mr. Khalid S.